Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Afte, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and its kingdom. We're in a different set today. I've been on the road, but I'm very pleased to say we are participating in the Conservative Partnership Institute's activities here on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and we have the benefit of their extraordinarily impressive studio setup. So we're grateful to CPI, as it's known, as well as his leader, Jim DeMint, who's making all this possible. We are going to be talking in the course of the day about a variety of challenges we're facing as a people. That's kind of our job. That's our beat day in and day out. But we are going to be talking first with one of our most distinguished and accomplished members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He is retired as the Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, capping a decades-long service to our country, in which he was holding forth courageously and with considerable adversity, I have to say, about the coming threat we faced from the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, he framed it for quite some time as the decade of concern that was going to be upon us before we knew it. He kept telling his senior colleagues in uniform and anybody else who would listen to him that the Chinese Communist Party was building up its military and had ambitions to use it and all kinds of other instruments to gain the dominant position in the world that it aspires to and that would entail necessarily the destruction of the United States to achieve that goal. Captain Fennell, you have co-authored with our friend and colleague, Dr. Bradley Thayer, a tremendously important, very timely new book entitled Embracing Communist China. It's all about the greatest strategic failure in our country's history. And I want to welcome you back, sir. We saw you a couple of weeks ago here in Washington. It's great to see you back home in Geneva. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Frank, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be with you again. Good to see you in D.C. So,
thank you. It was great to be with you on this Conservative Political Action Coalition's meetings. Jim, you participated in a great panel there, which we called World War Xi, and it certainly seems as though that's what's upon us. Give us a sort of level setting, if you would, Jim, on the decade of concern that... you have, as I say, been saying it's coming. Is it here? Are we in it? And what are the implications, if so?
Well, Frank, yes, we are in it. We're in the middle of it. We know from history and from evidence that former leader Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping had ordered the PLA going back 15 years plus to be ready to take Taiwan militarily starting in 2020. So that order had been given to them, and they had been basically conducting a military modernization from 2000 to 2020 to be prepared to conduct such an invasion. Now, some people quibble about whether or not they have that capability, but at this point, we're now in 2024, and we surmise, based on previous examples, that probably the latest that the PRC would attempt to use military force would be 2030, given that they're wanting to have a grand ceremony in 1 October 2049 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. So we called it the decade of concern, 2020 to 2030, as the most likely time that there could be a kinetic military operation. Unfortunately, it looks like that Xi and the party have accelerated that timeline. And what we're seeing here in the last 3 years is a really concerning number of actions that the PRC and the PLA have taken to demonstrate that they're ready soon, maybe at the end of this year or even next year, to launch such an invasion. And so we're seeing, for instance, continued high levels of increase to PLA spending. The two sessions, the National People's Congress that just concluded this week, talks to the fact that the Chinese are increasing their defense spending by 7.2% over their estimated GDP growth of 5%. We see the announcement of probably their new fourth aircraft carrier is going to be announced here quite soon. Their third one is out doing sea trials right now. So they went in the space of 10 years from not having any aircraft carriers to having three and almost four. We're seeing daily flights of aircraft that cross the Taiwan centerline after not for 60 years, only crossing it four times. We're seeing naval ships and drones and balloons fly in and around and over, and in case of the balloons, over Taiwan. We're seeing threatening activity against Japan and the Senkakus. We're seeing threats against the Philippines, renewed threats down at Second Thomas Shoal. So the PRC is making it very clear that they're going to restore all that they believe is rightfully theirs, even though there's no historical backing for that. They believe it's theirs, the South China Sea, Taiwan, the Senkakus, disputed territories with India and even Mongolia. So where they're conducting a genocide right now by erasing the language of the people of Mongolia. So across the board, Xi and the party are seeking to restore in what they call the great rejuvenation of China. And they want to have that wrapped up so that people will know it's done. If they have to do it kinetically, they'll get it done. And then everyone will forget about it, they believe. And then 1 October 2049, everybody will come to Beijing, kind of like they did in October or in August of 2008 for the opening ceremony of the Olympics. So we're kind of in this very dangerous time right now where the PRC has great military capability, great economic capacity. Even though they're having some downturn in their economy, they still have a large economy, and they can use that as a weapon against other nations, including the United States. And we are facing...
Captain, let me just interrupt here, because you've painted a very, well, I think comprehensive, but also very chilling picture of warlike behavior, if not actually kinetic just yet, certainly preparatory to it. And, you know, you just sort of hit on the key question that is on a lot of people's minds. The Chinese Communist Party is in very serious difficulty at home. Their economy is in distress, to say the least, if not extremis. Stock market, real estate market, banking system, population is in ferment, I think, as well, demographic challenges. So, Jim, where do you come down on this idea that, all of that really forecloses the kind of aggressive behavior that you're worried about? And if that's so, how would you explain the seeming disconnect here between what they're doing and those challenges?
Well, they're under two stresses, as you say. They've got clearly issues with their economy. They've got obvious issues inside what they call the factions inside the party. I still believe that Xi is in firm control. And he has, I think that is why, because of the pressures of the factions, I think he's accelerating his desire to achieve this restoration and rejuvenation sooner than they had probably wanted to do, but also because of our own failure. And that's the purpose of the
Let's book. Come back to that. Let's come back to that, and especially the thrust of your book. It's not a stay of execution, in other words, folks. In fact, it may be a catalyst to the aggressive behavior we're concerned about. Jim Fennell is in the house. Captain Fennell, the co-author of Embracing Communist China. We'll be right back with him and more. Stay tuned. Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The outcome of a House floor vote today to disarm the CCP of its lethal weapon doing business as TikTok may determine the future course of what is now properly called World War Xi. As our Committee on the Present Danger China has documented over the past 5 years, Chinese dictator Xi Jinping is engaged in unrestricted, pre-kinetic warfare against America. The CCP's weaponization of TikTok in such warfare is on full display today as our representatives vote on vitally needed bipartisan legislation that would shut the platform down unless its toxic algorithm, big data collection, and influence operations are terminated by new American owners. Congress must heed not the CCP's addicts and lobbyists, but the patriots who understand that a defeat in this fight may lead to decisive ones in the vital battles Xi has in store for us next. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and we are visiting with one of our favorite guests, but also one of our most admired comrades and colleagues. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He is a leading member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and has been one of the go-to resources for those of us who believe that the Chinese Communist Party is intent on not just displacing this country as the world's hegemon, as they like to say, but also destroying it in the process. Captain, you were just going into the next part of this discussion in terms of where we find ourselves, and it's the subject of your really important new book with our comrade and friend, Dr. Bradley Thayer, entitled Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. Talk a little bit about the failure on our part, both to internalize and adapt to the kinds of warnings that you have been making for so long, and the impact that that has had on Chinese planning that's brought us to the present pass.
Yeah, Frank. I mean, the origins of the book are really, Brad and I were trying to get after, how is it possible this previous segment, how did we get to such a state where we're seemingly threatened by a power that just 20 years ago couldn't even sail its navy outside the first island chain. And now all of a sudden it's got a knife to our throat. And as you said, not only seeking to displace us, but to destroy us in the process. So how did that happen? And it happened in large part because the very people that were charged with defending the United States, the national security community, our presidents, both Republican and Democrat over the years, and the intelligence community, failed to essentially recognize the threat of communist China. They dismissed the fact that it was a communist, ideologically driven country, that communism is the driver of China's politics. And unlike what we did in the Cold War, where we confronted communism and under Ronald Reagan, we defeated it, we had basically 50 years, the last 50 years of people saying, no, let's engage with China, because if we engage with them, we can bring them around basically to understand the benefits of accepting the international system that came out of World War II. And we did that initially for maybe right reasons, because we wanted to get after the Soviets and we thought we could use the Chinese to threaten the Soviets in their soft underbelly, if you will. But after about a decade or so of that in the early, you know, the 70s and into the early 80s, after that, it became clear that China was basically using our own avarice and greed and our own naivete to essentially take advantage of our weaknesses. And their leader at the time, Deng Xiaoping, created this strategy called hide and buy. And he basically said, I'm gonna bide my time. We're going to bide our time until we get stronger. We're going to hide our weaknesses, and we're going to take advantage of the Americans' generosity, and we're going to grow. We're going to get most favored nation status. We're going to get into the World Trade Organization. We're going to get trillions and trillions of dollars, which we will prioritize spending inside the PRC on the military, which they've been building for the last 25 years. And we will come to the point where we can control and be the arbiters of what's happened, what will happen not only in Asia, but around the globe. And so they did that. And our national security community failed to respond. And that's really the crisis.
So I just want to drill down on one of the key points you just made, the phenomenon of elite capture, as they call it, Jim, that went along with all of this, that induced people, even after it should have become absolutely transparent that we were being had, they persisted in saying, no, we need to just make them stronger and then they'll be more like us, and all will be well. And those trillions of dollars, Jim, not all of it, obviously, but a significant chunk of it came, as I understand it, from American investors, most of whom were not consulted about their money going into China, including into some of those companies, as you say, that are building up this immense threat to us. I mean, they're literally paying for the weapon systems that are designed to be used to kill, well, maybe our men and women in uniform, as you were, but also quite possibly the rest of us as well. Is that a correct understanding of how this has been essentially financed?
Yes, we have. You can look at, if you go back 30 years ago, China was around 6% of the world's GDP, and today it's around 18, 19% of the world's GDP. How did that happen? How did China go from being basically a third world nation, what they like to call themselves a developing nation, to now being the second largest, or some argue the largest economy on the planet? And they did some of that on their own, obviously, but in large part, it was funded by the United States and our investor class that went there and said, I can make a buck. And they were aided. They were aided in that investment because we had the academic community and our think tanks that were filled with what we call engagers. And the engagement crowd were all believers in this idea that if we engage, things will get better and China will come around. And combined with that was we had an intelligence community that went along with this engagement philosophy, and they threat deflated. We talk about threat deflation. So whenever there was a new system or a new weapon that the Chinese were making, you would have people in Washington, both in the government and in our think tanks, writing and talking about, well, this isn't really that important. And it's, oh, by the way, they haven't fought a war since 1979, and it's going to be decades before this or this or this will happen. And what we found is over this time is that over 30, 40 years, our intelligence community was continually, habitually underestimating and short-selling the growth of the PLA military and their economy in other areas.
Yeah. Jim, again, this is, a master class in how, as you say, we were taken down by the Chinese Communist Party. They haven't obviously completed the task, but they're well on their way. I just wanted to spend a minute talking about a piece of this complex transformation that is not, strictly speaking, the military or the kinetic kind. Unrestricted warfare, as you know, is what the Chinese have called it. And the prime instrument of this, and this is a very topical issue at the moment in Washington, the House of Representatives is expected shortly to vote on the question of whether or not TikTok, platform that the Chinese have brilliantly and addictively introduced to American young people, is a weapon being wielded against us to our great detriment, or whether it's just another so-called social media platform. Your thoughts about it, Captain, and what we should be doing about it as a question, particularly in this very context of this life and death struggle with the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, TikTok is part of the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare to destroy the United States of America. We can call it political warfare. We can call it a lot of different things. But the Chinese Communist Party knows what they're putting out on that platform. They don't allow what is on the American platform inside China because they know how corrosive and destructive it is to the morale and the minds, just the basic mental acuity and training of our youngest generation. They're destroying it, and they know they're doing it, just like they're purposefully sending fentanyl into the country. So these are prongs of attack, and TikTok, in my opinion, should be shut down. And I understand that the president is concerned about the impact because it may benefit another platform called Facebook, which that owner has used to attack the president. So I understand his frustration there.
We're talking about Donald Trump, the former president,
correct,
of course.
And so I would just say, if he were to ask me, which he hasn't, but if he were to ask me, I'd say, let's take it down and then let's figure a way to not allow Facebook to influence elections as well. But right now, the Chinese Communist Party is using TikTok purposefully as a weapon to attack our youngest generation and turn them against our nation and to turn their brains into mush.
This is a very compelling argument, I believe, for either shutting it down altogether or certainly making it over so that it stops being used to prepare the way for the destruction of this country, as you say, by the Chinese Communist Party. Captain James Fennell, thank you. Thank you for your important book with Brad Thayer, Embracing Communist China. Thank you for joining us from time to time on the program, and I hope you'll do it again very soon. We'll be right back with more, folks. I hope you'll stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of the country's, well, I would argue one of the world's leading experts on the issue of anti-Semitism. He is the author of numerous books that address it either very directly or indirectly. His name is Dr. Andrew Bostom, and he has been with us from time to time, but it's been a while, and we're glad to catch up with him because it turns out that at the moment, particularly at the hands of jihadis, but also their allies in what we call the red-green axis, namely Marxists of various stripes, anti-Semitism is flourishing, not just in the Middle East or in Europe, but actually here as well. And nobody follows it more closely or more astutely than Dr. Andrew Bostom. Welcome back, my friend. Good to have you with us. Give us an update.
Well, I think the Middle East Media Research Institute, which you know well, has really increased its surveillance of public access media for mosques, Islamic centers, and Muslim organizations. So things that are put into the public domain, and they've issued two very disturbing reports. Which both have the same summary conclusion over the last month or so, which is that since October 7th, surveilling hundreds of mosques and Islamic centers, and also following public events by major mainstream Muslim organizations in the United States, they cannot.
When you say mainstream, just to clarify, I think by that you mean Muslim Brotherhood affiliated.
But they are, yeah, they are. Unfortunately, that they represent the mainstream, and they've certainly captured the mainstream. Mm. They cannot find a single khutbah, a single sermon, or a single public event where there's open and direct condemnation of Hamas's atrocities on October 7th. Mm. On the other hand, they've cataloged, as you well know, many, many instances, I would say dozens at this point, of just overt jihadism and Jew hatred being espoused at these same events. And it's
so,
just
so in fact, if not explicitly being endorsed by these Muslim Brotherhood Front organizations, as what is to be thought or what is to be said or what is to be done in these Islamic centers and the various groups like CARE and so on. Is that right?
There seems to be a common dialogue. Now, much of it is very theological, is very religiously rooted in the themes that unfortunately come from the Quran, come from the traditions that are very anti-Semitic.
You have documented in your myriad
As I have documented,
books.
But yeah. it often goes into a vernacular that's just open calls for killing Jews and attacking Jews. And this is coming right out of mosques. And so I've tried over the last couple of weeks in particular, Frank, but, you know, ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, had its major gala last week, and they brought out, you know, the usual, you know, liberal intelligentsia amongst Jews, some of whom gave some excellent, you know, speeches. But the glaring lacoon in all this is dealing with the problem of institutional Islam in this country, not around the world, not at Al-Azhar University, which they don't deal with either, by the way, but right in this country. So I've been proposing that they simply team up with Memory, literally team up with Memory. Memory issues a report on video, documents, you know, can't deny what's being documented by these videos, you know, from mosques, from Islamic centers, from organizations, and that should immediately be coupled to a press release by ADL condemning. And if this happened
because
on a regular basis,
it just bears pointing out that that's supposed to be the job of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, is it not?
Bread and butter job, not some tangential feature of what they do. That is
why they exist.
That is their core mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm happy that they're pointing, you know, ADL has, in their defense, pointed out some of the awful things that are going on campuses, but this remains a third rail issue for them. And it is so important. And actually you can see the tie-in now between this traditionalist Islamic anti-Semitism and DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, because I can show going back 50 years now that Islamic scholars, the honest ones, like Maxime Rodin-Sahn, who was a strange case in certain ways, very anti-Zionist, but very good on Islam, and a Jew who had been a Marxist and eventually renounced Marxism. He wrote in 1974 that the academy was captured, that, as he put it, in terms of teaching Islam, understanding has given way to apologetics, pure and simple. And he specifically tagged what he called the post-colonial left as being responsible for this phenomenon. So this is not new. And
the post-colonial left would describe at least the current leadership of the Anti-Defamation League, would it not?
Unfortunately. Yeah. And
I guess the question, Andy, just to cut to the chase here, is, you're documenting, as is Memory, this upsurge in not just rhetorical anti-Semitism, but practiced, applied, weaponized anti-Semitism, some of it coming, as you've indicated, out of these radical institutions founded and run by the Muslim Brotherhood, whose mission, ladies and gentlemen, is to destroy Western civilization from within by our own hands, as well as the hands of the believers. This is right out of their blueprint for taking us down.
But it's also sometimes, Frank, it's hard to tell because it's proliferated to the point where near where I grew up, I just in Queens, New York, there was a viciously anti-Semitic sermon. Now, I don't know for sure, you know, what the origins of that mosque are. And I'm seeing this throughout the New York metro area that I'm familiar
with. Is it called an Islamic center?
Yeah.
Well, that's a clue, Andy. I think that's generally a brotherhood operation. But my point is that kind of practice, that weaponized anti-Semitism, if you will, is also now being exhibited in these, non-Muslim, in fact, secular or, atheistic Marxist groups as well, among other things, to try to save Hamas.
Exactly.
Are they not?
Exactly. Or the Houthis. I mean, there have been demonstrations at Columbia University. So this is the full manifestation of this red green alliance, which actually, Frank, dates back to Marx himself. Marx promoted an alliance with the Ottoman Empire to sow disruption.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they have a common enemy, the Chinese communists, for that matter, namely us. Yeah. Taking us down and getting out of Israel out of the way is just the first step in that war on Western civilization, Judeo-Christian civilization. And Andy, you've done as much as anybody with the Legacy of Jihad, among other really important books, to document the genesis of so much of this. I did want to reserve a little bit of time with you, Andy, because your profession, as opposed to this wonderful avocation, is in the kind of clinical epidemiology that made you a leader of the effort to both understand and counter effectively the COVID disease and the damage done by the so-called vaccines for it. There's been an important development in court recently, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about it. And I understand it's in stark contrast to something that you personally experienced in your native state of Rhode Island. Tell us about it.
So I was involved with two cases that were divorce cases. And divorces, Frank, parents will do anything they can to attack the other party. And so these were divorce cases where the disputed issue was vaccination of children, healthy children. In both cases, children who'd had prior infections and had natural immunity against the coronavirus.
And very limited risk of being harmed by it. Anyway,
the absolute risk for children is so low. It's really on the level of colds, where crazy things can happen. But we're in a period now where the serious consequences of COVID are one in a million in children. But at any rate, so in Rhode Island, which is a very blue, very COVID doctrinaire state. What happened was we went all the way to the Supreme Court and lost in a case like this, where the Supreme Court refused to even entertain an amicus brief, which came from worldwide pediatricians, very renowned people, former heads of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and basically with the same, and so that case we lost. Basically with the same fact pattern in Tennessee, except in this case it was adolescent boys as opposed to young girls, the parent that did not want them vaccinated, after I walked the judge through about 2.5 hours of literally a slide presentation, and he was very attentive, he decided in favor of the mother that did not want the children vaccinated, specifically because of natural immunity, low risk, potential harms of the vaccine. And it was an evidence-based decision for the first time that I've been directly involved with. And fantastic. I've been involved with a lot of litigation.
Andy, congratulations. And thank you for your leadership on so many of these fronts. You are usually taking principled and thoughtful positions that are desperately in need of promotion, and we so appreciate what you do in that regard. Come back to us with updates on all of this, if you would. And in the meantime, keep up the great work. How can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
I'm on X or Twitter, at Andrew Boston.
Andrew Boston.
My website is andrewboston.org.
Fabulous. Got to go. Okay. Thank you, Andy. Come back soon. Bye. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is Frank Afney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The outcome of a House floor vote today to disarm the CCP of its lethal weapon doing business as TikTok may determine the future course of what is now properly called World War Xi. As our Committee on the Present Danger China has documented over the past 5 years, Chinese dictator Xi Jinping is engaged in unrestricted, pre-kinetic warfare against America. The CCP's weaponization of TikTok in such warfare is on full display today as our representatives vote on vitally needed bipartisan legislation that would shut the platform down unless its toxic algorithm, big data collection, and influence operations are terminated by new American owners. Congress must heed not the CCP's addicts and lobbyists, but the patriots who understand that a defeat in this fight may lead to decisive ones in the vital battles Xi has in store for us next. This is Frank Gaffney.
Yes.
We're back, and what a red letter day this is. We have now a chance to visit with one of our leading experts, not just ours, but I think the country's, indeed the world's, leading experts on the insecurity of our border and the national and homeland security implications of it. His name is Todd Bensman. You know him well if you've been tracking our friend Steve Bannon's programs and others on the Real America's Voice Network, of course. You also should know him by his books, the most recent of which is entitled Overrun, about what Biden has done to create the greatest border crisis in the history of our country. Todd is associated with a tremendously important organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He's their National Security Fellow. But he brings a wealth of experience as an investigative journalist and is also an intelligence analyst for the Department of Public Safety in his native state of Texas, where a lot of the border insecurity is now, well, at catastrophic levels, I think it's fair to say. Todd, welcome back. It's been so long since we've talked, I think. It's long overdue. So welcome. We're glad to have you with us.
Always happy to be back.
Thank you. So, Todd, I wanted to start by just, again, excuse me. Todd, I wanted to start with, again, a bit of level setting. How would you characterize the state of the border that has been overrun? Is there still, in effect, a border at all at this point?
Well, in the last week, we have been averaging about 7,000 a day. Utterly catastrophic, 7,000 a day. But I will put that in the context that in November and December, we were seeing 12, 13, and 14,000 a day. The numbers have been declining a little bit just because two catastrophic levels, from ionospheric levels to catastrophic levels, in part because the Biden administration facing a re-election campaign in which this is the apex issue to the electorate, went to Mexico and cut some sort of a secret deal with the Obrador, Lopez Obrador administration to have them deploy 30,000 Mexican troops all along the northern border with us. And they've been rounding. It's very Donald Trump-esque. He could have done it at any time during the last 3 years. It would have been helpful to the country. But he chose to do it now because obviously the polls are showing this to be an apex issue, and he's got to do something to make the media cameras go elsewhere, go somewhere else. It seems like the media comes at about 13,000 a day, but anything under 10,000 a day, they go away. So you got to get that number down to below media interest threshold.
Well, this is a great way to make policy, isn't it?
Yeah.
If they're paying attention, then we have to. If they're not, we'll just let catastrophic levels persist. A particular concern to me, Todd, and I think to you as well, has been the presence among these vast numbers of a considerable population of people characterized as unaccompanied, fighting age Chinese men. And I'm wondering what your current readout is on how significant that part of this invasion is and its implications.
Well, the way I look at the Chinese coming across, and by the way, we've seen at least 45,000, probably closer to 50,000 or more, cross the border that we know of, and they turn themselves in. And I want to point out that all of them are simply waved through the turnstile with very little vetting. In fact, less vetting now than they were doing in the beginning of this crisis, where they would be sidelined and asked about 40 questions. The administration reduced the 40 questions to just 5 because it was taking too long to move them through. Now, my read on the Chinese coming through is that we don't really have any government information that's telling us what their associations were with the Chinese military, that they were not in the military or that they are not currently in the military. And I find that a problem, that we don't have any information. We can speculate that they are, but that doesn't really get us there. But what I will say is that without a doubt, with certainty, that there are agents of espionage in that flow. At the very least, there are spies coming through the border, because that's just what the Chinese Communist Party does. That's what they do, the PLA. They've done it. They've taken advantage of every single one of our other visa programs, the legal visa programs, to insert spies in our research institutes and our military and everywhere else they possibly can. Of course, they're bringing them in over the border. We'll find out about them in 10 years.
Todd, we have to take a short break here in a moment, but just quickly, when you are bringing your skill set to bear here, obviously, you know that people simply collecting intelligence is a problem. But people who are here with the skills and the mission of actually engaging in sabotage or destruction of infrastructure more broadly, or assassinations, or any number of other things, maybe even I will particularly worry about, you know, marrying up with biological laboratories that the Chinese seem to have scattered around our country, we think. That's a whole different kettle of fish, as they say. Is that something you worry about as well?
Well, I'll default on that to the 2024 Homeland Security threat assessment that just published a month or two ago that talks all about the threat from the CHICOMs. It says, that document says, that agents of the Chinese government will do these things. One, they will disrupt our election using AI-driven social media campaigns. They have secret, discreet, I'll say, police stations inside the United States, according to the 2024 assessment, in which they are operating to suppress dissidents inside the United States through physical violence, intimidation, and kidnapping. They call it rendition, to trick these American citizens of Chinese origin to leave the country so that they can take them back to the homeland and probably imprison them or torture them or kill them or whatever. But that's happening in the United States, according to our own government, just within the last couple of months. And also, these Chinese agents are expected to be spying in other ways on our infrastructure to try to find targets and opportunity. And
targeting, in other words. Todd, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a bit about other immigrants that we also have to be worried about, and the UN that seems to be facilitating their entry here. We'll be right back with more with Todd Bensman, the author of Overrun, right after this. We're back, and Todd Bensman is in the house. I'm pleased to say Todd has been following closely the immigration problem worldwide, not just here in the United States. And that gives him a perspective on what's happening and not just to us, but to others as well, obviously. And one of the takeaways, Todd, I know from your recent reporting, is that the United Nations is playing a big role in promoting migration, as they call it, illegal. And that's something I just don't quite get. Illegal immigration is apparently something you're not allowed to talk about anymore, right? I mean, literally not allowed to use the word illegal. But it is illegal, especially as they're migrating, shall we say, to our country. So where does the UN fit into all of this? And who's paying for them to do what they're doing?
Well, we have insight into all of this, brand new insight, from a United Nations program budget document that was published for 2024 online, where they are calling for $1.6 billion to hand out to 248 NGOs all along the southern approaches to our border. That is all intended.
This is just for the United States. This is not getting people into Europe or getting them elsewhere.
It's just for the United States. It's just for the United States portion. They have billions more for Europe and the rest of the world. But this is money that is largely coming directly from the U.S. State Department, and in very, very close, almost no daylight between them, between the USAID, the U.S. State Department, and these U.N. agencies that are handing out this cash and aid and assistance all along the approaches to our border. The IOM, UN, United Nations International Organization for Migration, is literally a managerial arm of the State Department. These UN organizations, in turn, are using 248 identified, publicly identified NGOs to hand the cash out, and I mean cash in envelopes, in debit cards, and as humanitarian transportation at way stations that are set up all along. This is very well established now after 3 years of this at very developed, highly developed way stations that is aiding and abetting the movement of immigrants to our border. And wittingly and knowingly, when you read their documents, they talk about openly, we know that they are moving through and we're going to help them move through. And that is most definitely happening. $372 million just for cash credit cards. Millions and millions of dollars for humanitarian transportation, for shelter, for lodging assistance, for every possible human need to get through to our border.
So when you say the U.S. State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, you're talking about American taxpayers. You're talking about people like us are making this invasion possible.
Tens of people.
Streamlining it, facilitating it, enabling it, enriching, among others, I imagine, the cartels along the way as well. No?
Yes, the State Department and USAID are the primary funders of this. They are actually increasing their budgets by 100%, 200%. And sending that cash down to the border lands, all the way down into South America. This is
infuriating, Todd. You have to put up with this all the time, but it's just unbelievable. Gobsmacking, as they say. Let me turn to one last issue. Also, in the nature of shocking, you've been tracking a practice that the administration has been using that spares at least some of these illegal immigrants from going through the messy business of actually having to get through the Darien Gap or get across the border through the cartels and all the rest of it. We just fly them in and fly them in some surreptitious way. Talk a little bit about that. And Todd, the possibility, I've heard you talk about this with Steve Bannon, I believe, that a similar mechanism might be used in the future to move large numbers of Palestinians into our country as well.
Yeah, this is a flights program that the administration stood up in October of 2022, and then expanding it in January 2023, where illegal immigrants who were going to cross our border can now just apply or have a relative apply on their behalf to fly in. And the numbers are huge. This is not a few here and there. It's 320,000 in a one-year period that were flown directly from foreign airports into American airports. They have to pay their own way or arrange their own flights, but the U.S. is authorizing those flights in undisclosed locations throughout the Americas, but also they refuse
to... Throughout the United States of America, I think you're
right. Well, right, and throughout the United States. And they're refusing to tell us the names of those airports, and that's what I've written about recently, is they finally said why. The reason why they're not telling us the airports is because they're bringing so many in that they've created security vulnerabilities at these airports. And they're saying, if we tell you, then the bad guys will find out where we've stretched our security at American airports and exploit them, which is outrageous. I mean, that is an official claim of the U.S. government. Now, could they? They're primarily just flying in nine nationalities. Gazans and Palestinians are not one of those, but there's a sister program where they're escorting them in over the land borders. 450,000 more are just being escorted over the land borders where you can't even see it.
Now, when you say 450,000 of them, you don't mean 450,000 Gazans or Palestinians, do you? But that's a coming thing. And we have to have you back. We're almost out of time, Todd. Whether this port that Joe Biden is now building for the Palestinians is going to be a means of getting hundreds of thousands more on ships and bring them here surreptitiously as well, that's for another day. Todd Bensman, thank you for your great work for the Center for Immigration Studies Overrun, your great new book, and for joining us from time to time. Come back again soon, if you would.
Thank you.
The rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.